sometimes I just get these feelings of like everything's going to be okay, and then they get kind of dashed as fairly soon, and then I feel like everything's
going
bad.
I was
going
to say, by what basis would you start thinking everything's going to be okay? That, irrational, you know, exuberance?
That no, not that. Just, you know, maybe we aren't headed for a complete Orwellian top-down dystopia.
We're definitely not. It's going to be far worse than that.
Are you turning doom and gloom just because I came into the conversation? I love it.
No, that was just good timing on your part.
It's going to be much worse. Continue, please. I'm seeing more dystopian stuff.
It's time for the Access of Easy podcast.
And to substantiate, the reason it's going to be much worse is it's going to be decentralized. At least a top-down authoritarian society, you know who to oppose, you know who to resist, you know who to fight. But when the tyranny is invisible, when it's an algorithm that's decentralized and doesn't exist on a single server, well, how are you supposed to fight it? How are you supposed to identify it? How are you supposed to resist it? I think that's the paradox.
We got to start recording, Mark.
I'm already recording. I usually stop around now to test it, but I'm not going to, because it actually brings to mind something exactly that I was going to pose to you today this week. Quick intro, Access of Easy, Salon number 23 with Jesse Hirsch, Charles Hugh Smith. I'm Mark Jeftovic, and that's it for the intro. Let's just get into it. Charles, I caught your appearance on Chris Martinson's Peak Prosperity this week, so that was a good interview.
Oh, thank you.
But to Jesse's point, if there's no top-down, centralized Big Brother, you know, the eye of the pyramid that the tinfoil hat... You know, I just never noticed the tinfoil hat and the eye on top of the pyramid have the same shape. But so if there's no single centralized source of control to oppose, and it's a decentralized and it's an algo, is there a danger, let's say Charles Hugh Smith's climb system swept the world and became a prevalent currency or a dominant currency, aren't we the same slaves to the algo because the climb system takes human judgment out of it, in the sense that it's all regulated by an algorithm, because you're trying to eliminate the corruption that's inherent in most systems, but won't we run a risk of being slaves to the algo?
Yeah, Jesse, you want to pick up on that?
I won't pick up on it, but I'll riff off it. Other than, you know, the point of the decentralized is it's not algo in the singular, it's algorithms in the plural. That we might be able to figure out one algorithm, but there could be many others operating in terms of making decisions, sorting, ranking, and filing. I mean, I was teasing or making fun of the dystopian outlook by saying it's a slippery slope, that no matter how bad a scenario you could think of, you can come up with one that's even worse. And I think that is the paradox of the dystopia we currently live in, that on the one hand, we're not doing all that badly, all things considered. And yet at the same time, if you look around, you have every reason to be upset and freaking out and going, oh my God, where are we headed? So it's a bit of a paradox when it comes to the pandemic of paranoia.
Well, let me introduce something that I picked up on in the reader comments thread on that Chris Martinson podcast I did. And what the general, and I've noticed this from many readers over the 5 years that I've, since I've introduced the climb system, is the instinct of otherwise, kind of normal, conventional, good people is, the first thing they want to do is slam anything that smacks even slightly of idealistic goals. No, that will never work. Human nature is so dark and greedy and evil that there's no possibility of any system working that relies on cooperation and shared values. And it's all like, do you guys realize how insane that you are saying that kind of thing? That, like, you know, there's lots of examples in history and human society that people actually are programmed to cooperate on, you know, positive goals, et cetera, et cetera. And that systems have to be, they have to provide something, some way to get ahead, or there's a shared consensus. I mean, even like the Roman Empire, right? I mean, it worked because it gave a lot of people citizenship in this huge economy, and they could see, hey, I could get ahead. And why did they have, up until the end, why did they have such, you know, powerful army? Well, you joined the army as an outcast or a misfit or somebody that, you know, the empire conquered a few decades ago. You got a pension, which was pretty ample after you did your 20 years in the army, and you became a citizen. And so you had all these rights. And so, hey, it works for me, right? I don't really care whether you call it a republic or an empire. It works for me, right? So, and so the idea that climb could work because it's an opt-in that, hey, I can get ahead better by joining this system than being outside, that just goes right over everybody's head. It's like, oh no, you know, people are not going to cooperate. It's going to be evil and corrupt, and, you know, and it's all like, it all depends on the transparency of the system, and, you know, and whether it's clear it's going to work for you or not. And so, like, I compare it to corporations, because a corporation, nobody says, oh, corporations, that, you know, we don't know what they're going to do. They're all evil. It's all like, well, look at it. If the corporation says it's going to do X, and we all know it's there to make as much profit as possible, then everybody buys into it. They use eBay, they use PayPal, they use this, they use that. And everybody knows, hey, it's got to be somewhat fair, right? Because they want to make money, and it has to work for the customers and the participants, right? And so they have this assumption that corporations know what they're doing and that they're trustworthy, because we know they're greedy. Okay, so that's fine. But it's like, so if you set up something that's a community corporation, then suddenly it's impossible. It can't work because it's too idealistic. And so I just wanted to introduce these topics of values, transparency, you know, so where are the algos coming from and what's their purpose? And if they're untrustworthy, like we, you know, we're given some PR and we don't really trust the purpose of the organization, then we're not going to trust the algorithms, right? But it is possible to have a trustworthy organization.
It's just, so,
yeah.
I mean, I think your point about transparency is spot on. And I think that's why we're in the dystopia we're in. And that's why this dystopia has a track or a trend that is even more disturbing, because it's going in the opposite direction of transparency. And it's creating systems that are anti-transparent. But I want to push back a little, Charles, with your lament or your criticism of the lack of people being able to see the benefit to themselves of your system. I think very few people have the level of abstract thinking that allows them to position themselves forward into the future and see benefit. But what they all have is envy. What they all have is the ability to look at other people, see those people benefiting, and then out of envy go, I want what they have. And I think that's where transparency and, you know, the climb system as one example could catch on, is if people could see other communities prosper, and if people could see other communities having advantages from the system that makes them go, wow, I want that too. How come I can't have that? We better adopt that system so that we can also have the grass that is growing over there on the other side of the road. And I think that's one of the, not flaws in human psychology, but vulnerabilities in human psychology, that it's easier for us to see the economic loss of opportunity in someone else's gain than it is for us to imagine our own gain and structure our behavior accordingly. And I think that's why people, and I also despise that people's reaction is always, oh, that's never gonna happen, or there's no faith in that. And yet traffic is the best example. People hurtle down roads at hundreds of kilometers, you know, many miles an hour, with their life so precarious. But yet we have this shared belief system that we're not going to kill each other and that we're going to handle intersections. And now, granted, that's a symptom of a society breaking down, which I referenced in an earlier episode around why I left Toronto. But it does speak to how there are all these belief systems that we share that allow us to do miraculous things, and we take them for granted rather than thinking about how they can be applied to other aspects of our lives. Which, you know, Mark, to a point you consistently bring up, traffic is much more a protocol than a platform, right? We have protocols for how to deal with traffic. We have frameworks for how to deal with traffic, rather than, say, toll roads, which are platforms, which we all despise. We'd rather be able to drive wherever we want and have the types of protocols that govern us no matter where we are.
You know, it was funny. I was thinking about the traffic, that exact point this morning, because I was taking M to school and we're blasting down the QEW, and this truck is coming a little close to his lane, and I'm getting ready to, like, well, maybe I got to take evasive action or I got to tap on the horn. And then he kind of stopped and kind of corrected. And I my exact thought was, there is a whole lot of trust moving down this road at very high speed right now. And for the most part, people are trustworthy. I mean, even not just among their inner groups of family and clan and tribe and groups, but even with complete strangers. And that's why it does crack me up when I hear people, as a libertarian, I hear the contra arguments a lot. And, you know, one of them is, you need big government because people are evil and corporations are evil. So you need big government. And then you ask them, well, who makes up the government? People do. So do people stop becoming evil as soon as they become a member, a person in the government? I mean, I think experience shows if there's any kind of transformation, it's the exact opposite. But, you know, just in the sense of the corruption that comes baked into having that position of being able to personally benefit from shaping the rules that govern society. But the point you were making at the top of the show about competing algos, again, that's an important point, because I think even the more conspiratorial minded or paranoid minded, of which I am both sometimes, feel like I have to remind myself there's too much incompetence in the world for there to be this unified unity at the top. That's sort of the plandemic narrative, right? It's all George Soros and Bill Gates, and they got together and they just, you know, whiteboarded it out, and now they're just running the plan. It's competing factions at all levels of society, whether it's street gangs in a neighborhood or rivals within a political party, one of which is, you know, totally incumbent and entrenched into the fabric of the political machinery of a country. There's still competing factions in there and competing factions within that. And so it's all this chaotic, balkanized hodgepodge of competing interests. And that's, again, one of the reasons I am a free market person, because I believe that it's one of the few systems that actually optimizes the incentives around self-interest and acting in your own interest that actually works in the wider society's favor, because the genius, I guess, in the architecture, and it's not really an architecture, again, it's almost more of a protocol than a platform, is it takes two sides to make a transaction. You have to have a buyer and you have to have a seller, and that transaction's not going to happen unless both of them think that there's something in it for them. And that way you get that rarity of configurations where everyone's looking out for themselves, but they have to cooperate to make that happen. But see, you look like you want to say something.
Well, and that's where I feel that the phrase free market is loaded, in that not everyone is free. And I think, to Charles's point, there has to be a certain level of transparency to not only ensure that freedom, but verify that freedom. Because when I look at the marketplace, too often I don't see a transaction between two free parties.
Especially instead, with surveillance capitalism and that kind of thing. Yeah, and take it or leave it terms of service.
But you know, markets don't happen in a vacuum. Now, obviously, monopoly is part of this dynamic in which that freedom is removed. But that's what I mean by the phrase free market, I think, is loaded, in that different people have different definitions of what it means to be free. And where theoretically I agree very much with what you argue for, it's just the details under which that is achievable, because you often have power imbalances. You often have violence. You often have force and coercion that are behind the scenes of a transaction, which is why I appreciate Charles's call for transparency, because it's easier to identify those dynamics when you have transparency. So you can get a sense of when a landowner is taking advantage of the serfs on his land, or whether collusion has resulted in the monopolization of a commodity. Like, there's all sorts of scenarios in which that starts to break down. But I think fundamentally what we're describing here is the type of system in which people have awareness, in which they have knowledge, in which they understand the transactions taking place, in which they have the ability to consent or engage with those transactions. And that's where I was arguing that the algorithms make that impossible, and that we're entering into a type of world, you know, to your point, Mark, about competing algorithms, where if you don't have an algorithm working on your behalf, you're finished, you're done. You shouldn't even show up in the game. It's the same way that, you know, you would be a fool to represent yourself in a court of law when we all know that the most expensive lawyers tend to have the best resources, tend to deliver justice. That's why they charge what they charge. So there's, I appreciate your acknowledgement that the quote unquote global elite is a very complicated, albeit incestuous, but divided, you know, phenomena. The same is true of everything, right? And so in that sense, where you'd be a fool to represent yourself in a court of law, you'd be a fool to engage in the algorithmic society without an algorithm working on your behalf. And there are very few of us who can construct an algorithm to work on our own, to have our self-interest as its primary operating interest. But that's what is necessary in the present, not just in the future, to actually have a free market or for people to be democratic citizens in this empire we're in. Otherwise, to bring it back to Marx's evocation of the Roman Republic or Empire, none of us are citizens, right? We aspire to citizenship. We wish that we were citizens, but it's only people who have the capacity to have an algorithm working on their behalf, as well as a legal team, as well as all sorts of other resources, that have the ability to say that they are citizens in this current empire. And I think that's the problem. That we need to lower the bar. We need to make it far easier for people to attain citizenship, i.e. equality and freedom, so that we have a democratic society rather than a dystopia.
Go ahead, Mark.
I'll be quick.
No, yeah.
It was Charles who brought up the Roman thing. I think you said Mark by just a
second. Sorry, I meant to say Charles.
Yeah. I think we like a housekeeping definition semantic thing. I picked free market as my choice of words because I think capitalism is also horribly loaded. And so we've been having some conversations around that these last few sessions of what do we even call it? And one idea, I was looking for a book that was on my book caddy here, and I think it's downstairs, about agorism. I've just started reading it, and how to opt out of the technocratic state. And I think it was a...
See, what I like about the word free market is everyone knows it. So I'd rather that we unpack such a word.
Yeah.
Because it is so accessible.
Yeah. So, you know, we face the same conundrum still because we may be looking at words that aren't widely known or using words that are front-loaded with bad connotations. But what we need... Following on your point, is you need like an algorithmic advocate. And while I sort of poo-poo AI as sort of an overblown, overhyped thing that's really just an expert system, I don't think we'll ever have artificial intelligence. But what I do think we will have in spades is augmented intelligence, so that you will be augmenting yourself via algorithms. And what you really need, you'll need that extra leverage that you can only get through harnessing that computing power, so that you would have something that can maybe almost negotiate on your behalf all of these microtransactions that are going to be happening, that are already happening around you every day. I'm going to let you back in a sec, Charles. But a book I'm thinking about right now is Doc Searle's The Intention Economy, which he wrote, got to be 14 years ago by now. But he really sort of...
Let's invite him on as a guest, eh? He'd be a great guest.
Let's do that. You know what? He would probably come on. Maybe he would come on. So that Intention Economy book talked about a world like that, although I think he wrote it before a lot of this went really toxic and seemingly malevolent. But we are heading into a place where I think you're going to need that algorithmic advocacy around you. Go ahead, Charles.
Okay. Well, I'm going to backfill slightly on a couple of topics. I think it's very interesting. The topic you guys have about the algorithmic advocacy is profound. And I want to backfill a little bit behind that. So, and then proceed forward is the whole idea of values. And that I'm going to speak about values as and the economy and society is that what a lot of people who study this kind of stuff notice is that high trust societies and economies like the Scandinavian countries, right? People go, why are they so successful? You know, and you can say, well, because there's only between 5 and 14 million people per country, so it's less than LA County. That helps, okay? you know, you have a small, coherent society, but trust is very high in these very successful, open, democratic, and remarkably free market, if you will, economies with a heavy, you know, welfare state social network. And then you look at corrupt, stagnant, low growth, authoritarian societies and economies, and you discover extremely low trust throughout the entire network. I mean, if you look at society and the economy as networks, right, the whole network is extremely untrustworthy. So what you do is you only have a family business. You know, and you can only trust people literally within one or two connections of you in the network, right? So the Scandinavian will trust somebody, you know, 100 nodes away, because it's like there's a whole society of trust, right? And it's been built up over hundreds of years and all that stuff. So I look at it now, and I think part of the dystopia we're talking about is a loss of institutional or network trust, right? And so the idea is, well, can we get some sort of system that all of us can opt into, in that we can restore that level of systemic trust, i.e. that it is transparent? And when we talk about free markets, I immediately go back, as I often do, to Braudel's, you know, 1,000+3-volume work on the beginnings of capitalism in Europe, right? And I think what part of what you guys are addressing, but implicitly, is how corruptible is a market. And so in the traditional markets, you know, the souks and all that stuff, everybody's kind of on the same level of wealth and access to power and all that stuff. And so, you know, the asymmetry that Jesse was speaking about, you know, how there could be power asymmetries, so there's no free market. And so what capitalism does in the sense that Braudel was researching it in the 14th, 15th, 16th centuries is money, huge amounts of capital can come into a local market, and then they can completely dominate it because the asymmetry of wealth and power is so extreme. And so what you want to do is you want to protect your market from the kind of exploitation that happens when some huge asymmetric power is allowed in as if they're just like one of us. And of course they're not, right? So you wanna ring fence your market, you know, so that it's, otherwise it'll never be free, because if you allow in asymmetric players, then number one, trust is lost, because, you know, and also they dominate the market. You get monopolies, you get corruption. So I look at what you guys are discussing is how do we establish, whether it's the entire society or simply a ring-fenced part that you can join to create the kind of social and economic trust that creates a beneficial society and that's resistant to corruption and asymmetry. And so that's the challenge in my view.
Well, and that's where the word antitrust is so relevant. right? That antitrust is, on the one hand, you're trying to make sure that the trust embedded in the market, the trust embedded in the network is protected, and that it's monopolies, it's asymmetrical participants who erode, if not dissolve, that trust. And that is what the digital monopolies have done, is in place of a trust system, they introduced a rating, reputation, and popularity system that you just trust that the other reviewers are being honest and that they're not lying as to why you believe that eBay seller or that Amazon seller or that YouTuber. And it, you know, I fundamentally agree with everything you said, Charles, in terms of the value of trust in a democratic society versus the scarcity of trust in authoritarian society. But what I feel the digital platforms have innovated or revolutionized, dare I use that phrase, is replacing trust with reward. That there is no trust on these systems. I mean, the newsletter issue I wrote today was about YouTube's tyranny of copyright enforcement. That there, no one knows why they do it. There's really no way for a credible appeal. And your entire business can be wiped out. You can be deplatformed just because someone else, some copyright troll, made a complaint against you. And so there's no trust in such a system. And yet people still continue to flock to YouTube when there are ample alternatives because they want the reward, right? They want the reward that comes from gaining popularity on these systems. So to your point, trust has been replaced by faith. And it's a kind of faith in the attention lottery, right? In the idea that you could go viral or you could be a celebrity and then you could be rich. There's no trust that should tell you that believe that that would happen. But in having faith in the gods of YouTube or having faith in the gods of Facebook, that such a thing will happen. That is the neo-feudal world we live in that these platforms benefit from the lack of trust. They benefit from the absence of antitrust action. And it's like we should be, what I found so fantastic about your remarks, Charles, is it reminds us why we should be focusing once again on trust. And Mark, that brings us back to your profound point about traffic on the QEW, that we have a profound amount of trust to the trucks and other vehicles around us. I mean, I used to experience that as a motorcyclist because you were even more vulnerable. But it did remind me that it's not just about trust, it's about consequence. Mm-hmm. And it's not just physical consequence in terms of your life. It's the demerit points in terms of getting busted. It's the shaming now in terms of idiots with cars and someone having their dash cam record your bad behavior. I think all of that kind of goes in tandem. And that's why antitrust is so important, because it's the penalties to people who want to make the market unfree, who want to restrict or remove the freedoms that are embedded in that market. And I think those consequences are essential to ensuring the type of freedom that people desire.
You know, I don't mean to make these episodes like a litany of book reports or book club or something, because I talk about a lot of books, but we were talking
You're a bibliophile. It's okay.
I know. We were talking, me and somebody else were talking about high trust, low trust societies. And he said, you've got to get Francis Fukuyama's trust. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Francis Fukuyama, like the end of history guy? And this is what I call people out for. He said, Mark, have you ever read The End of History? I'm like, actually, no. Said, well, you got to read it before you actually make a pronouncement on it, but get the trust book first. And it talks about exactly what we're talking about in here. And believe it or not, Stephen Harper actually advocated in his last book, which I think is right here, right now, the exact thing you were talking, was it you or was it Charles that was saying, you know, creating, protecting the market itself from an asymmetric outsized force or interloper or whatever. And he was talking about the whole neoliberalism had gone too far with what we, you know, becoming too reliant on China's economy and the China supply chain and the zombie economy there is feedbacking into a zombie economy here. And it's all the same kind of concern, I think, that sometimes you have to start right in your local area and just build that trust there. And then you have to protect it somehow through rules, incentives, what you said, Jesse, consequences.
Yeah,
well, but trust.
I appreciate your books, Mark, because really books, whether you read them digitally or in dead tree print, they really are the only way to learn something. That's abstract. You know, YouTube is university's perfect for practical skills, but if you're going to dig into something abstract, it's pretty hard to get there without somebody who's organized this stuff for you in a book. So I appreciate that.
And but I
we
think
also have to refer. Yeah, go ahead.
I cut you off. Sorry.
No,
One of my personal ideological things is that if all of society read more, and I don't mean blog posts and tweets, I mean actual books, whether you're listening to it in audiobook or reading it on a Kindle or dead tree books, I just think society should read more. I just think there's no downside to everyone. If everyone read 1,000 books by the time they're out of university or in middle age, I think there would be a lot less dystopia.
So I'll just quickly flag, I'm going to rebut both of you. But
Charles, you've read more than 1,000 books. You don't know what you're talking about.
Charles, kidding. Please go ahead and make your point before I rebut.
Okay. I'm going to refer back. When we get into this kind of thing, I always go back to the original Star Trek series. Sorry. That's kind of like one of those, like Foundation, you know, like Asimov, we always refer back to Foundation because it's just foundational, right? Well, so is the, you know, first Star Trek. And so there's, in terms of trust, I like the episode whereby all the war is digital. And then, you got hit.
Yes.
You're a casualty now.
I remember that.
by trust, you have to go into the vaporizing machine. And so the Star Trek crew decided not to trust the system. And they rebelled against being casualties. And so, and yet the appeal of this was it was all very clean, you know, instead of the chaos of war that, it was all handled by algorithms, algorithmic war. Anyways, okay, take it away, Jesse.
Well, I was just going to say that what you guys are talking about is abstract thinking and critical thinking. And, you know, books happen to be a very powerful tool that sometimes engenders both critical thinking and abstract thinking. But I think you guys make a mistake in universalizing your personal experience, that just because you guys were able to achieve abstract thinking and critical thinking through the medium of books does not in any way mean that everyone else does. Because there are lots of people who read books but fail to achieve abstract thinking or critical thinking. And there are lots of people who don't read books who do achieve abstract thinking and critical thinking. Now, what I would argue is that abstract thinking and critical thinking are shockingly scarce in our current contemporary period. And it is something that we wish were more widespread and we would like to see more widespread. And I will agree that books are a very powerful tool to encourage them. But books alone will not achieve that. And further, we should not focus on the means when our ends is to encourage abstract and critical thinking, to which I would say, especially for people who are not of your particular culture and demographic, that they are finding abstract and critical thinking via other tools and other media. With that said, I think the power of podcasting is abstract thinking and critical thinking. And that's the irony, that I think we absolutely provide a value to our audience when we recommend books, partly because that's us doing what you say the author does, which is select knowledge that will help them expand their horizons. And that's what we're doing in terms of offering them the book. But I would argue that the podcast itself, that the dialogue, the Socratic dialogue that the three of us engage in, very much fosters an abstract critical thinking that is comparable, and I would even potentially argue sometimes more powerful than books, because we're reverting, and that's why I evoked Socrates, we're reverting to a dialogic approach. We're reverting to a conversational approach that predates the printed word and still fosters tremendous abstract and critical thinking. And I think that's part of the value that we as philosophers offer to our audience, which is where I will take the usual algorithmic opportunity to say, hit the like button, post a comment below, share this with your friends. And the irony is that while we do this tongue in cheek, we literally depend upon it. That we still depend upon algorithms to share these ideas with other people, which then might foster abstract and critical thinking. So there's a meta view to all of this, which is a kind of infinite lens in which I think that that algorithmic advocate is something we needed yesterday, is something that we require today, that's part of what we do here in the podcast, because we're kind of acting as algorithms, selecting and recommending books and ideas and concepts to our audience. So we're an example of a human collaborative algorithmic advocate. But I think that we need to be thinking about how these algorithmic advocates can emerge on a kind of immediate basis, because I think the longer we wait, the better the other resources, the greater the asymmetry when it comes to the marketplace of ideas that we currently find ourselves in terms of the original idea of what would it be like if everyone decided that Charles's Klein system was the basis of organizing an economic society, or to Markhamite discussion, what makes a market free? I think these are the debates that have to happen right now. Because look, the thing that frustrates me overwhelmingly is the misuse of the word socialism. I mean, I'm all for a debate as to socialism and what it is. But the fact that the Republican Party of the United States accuses the Democrats of being socialists when they're nothing of the kind, or that they're arguing that there's some kind of socialist threat looming on the horizon when there's nothing of the sort, that type of demagoguery, that type of manipulation, that type of straight out lies, that to me are the symptoms not just of a dystopia, but of fascism, quite literally, in which you're creating a character of your opponent that is entirely inaccurate for the sole purpose of justifying your violence, which is where we are with the current president saying that he's not going to hand over the office peacefully, that if he loses the election, he's going to, I mean, again, ludicrous stuff, but coming from the horse's mouth, so it's difficult to not recognize the dire times that we're in.
Mark, let me just jump in real quick and say, I agree with you, Jesse. There's a lot of the media, and I just want to say that on a positive note, you guys often mention other podcasts. I do that less. We also reference movies, TV shows, and fiction. So I think we're curating, right? And that's, talk about scarcity. I've read so many articles saying that what people are paying for now is not content, they're paying for curation. Like they want somebody else who's informed to kind of like, you know, cut through some of the clutter and get something useful. And so when Mark and I reference a book, or we reference, you know, if you reference a podcast, I think what we're trying to do sort of just naturally is, here's the source of my curation. In other words, this is why I've selected this idea or meme to present, and here's my foundation so you can look back at it. In other words, there's kind of a backstory that, where did this curation come from, right? Like, why should we trust you guys, or is your curation have any validity? And so by sourcing it, then it helps the listener decide if that curation is valid. So anyways.
And I tried to make a similar point a couple of episodes ago where, you know, Mark was talking about some stuff that he had read, and I was like, yeah, I'm never gonna read that because you read it for me. And that to me is part of the logic of curation, that there's only a certain amount of time in the day or in our lives. We can't read everything. So of course there's stuff that Charles has read that I'm grateful, Charles, that you've read it, because you'll synthesize it for me and give me that knowledge in a bite, and I'll do the same with you. And that's part of building a kind of knowledge network where we learn from each other.
Yeah, one of my pet projects that I probably won't get done this year is a book called Success in 60 Seconds, where you sort of take famous, hugely successful people and you distill the nature of their success to one sentence and then just kind of expand on it for the page. Like, Warren Buffett would be the best time to buy snow shovels is in the summer. Wayne Gretzky is I skate to where the puck is going to be, not where it is. John Templeton, buy at the point of maximum pessimism, all of those, right? And you can just distill it down. And of course, you can't do it justice to a real aficionado of that person, but you can at least get the core sort of essence of what those people stood for.
I want to jump in and go back quickly, okay. Backfill to one of our topics that we were talking about, values and stuff. And that, you know, there's a book, William Goldman, you know, it was very famous, huge book, sold millions in the early 60s, Lord of the Flies. And his scenario, it was a book of fiction, scenario was a bunch of teenage boys are shipwrecked on an island. And a dystopian future unfolds because the human nature is evil. And the most, you know, so the asymmetry within, you know, any human population, the most powerful and evil will take over and exploit everybody else, right? And so that was a hugely successful book because I think it sort of met everybody's expectations. You know, they wanted to believe in a way that's like, ooh, you know, humans are evil. And look at all the war and the tragedy. And then there was an actual living experiment that was it was not planned, is that a bunch of teenage boys took a sailing ship and went off on their own. They basically kind of just played hooky. The boat broke down. They were shipwrecked on an island. And it turned out to be the exact opposite of the Lord of the Flies. And there were older boys and younger boys. So there was asymmetry. And they They cooperated, and there was also multi-ethnics. There were Caucasians and Pacific Islanders, and so they created this whole amazing little village of their own, including like a badminton court, and they had they organized the work parties. There were always two people on duty or doing these various tasks, and they had a conflict resolution mechanism, you know. And so it's all like, well, wait a minute, these are just like young people, you know? I mean, maybe the oldest was 16 or something. And so it goes to show, I think, very powerfully that no matter how many examples of human greed and evil and exploitation you can dig up, there is an equal number of humans have to cooperate because that's the source of our actual survival mechanism, is not being exploitative and evil and greedy. It's actually being able to cooperate and create, to Jesse's point, these networks of knowledge. That's what's allowed us to take over the planet, not being evil and greedy. So you can say, well, that part of human nature does exist, right? But there's another part too. And so when we're talking about high trust and low trust, we're kind of saying, where is that scale, that the rules, the protocols in the society that go from high trust to low trust, you know? And that's and in the low trust society, then you get more evil, you get more greed, you get more asymmetry, you get more exploitation and less trust. So I think so the algorithms that we're talking about, there has to be a value system behind them. That's what I think. And that's, most people don't talk about values, or they break down into some politicized thing of conservative or progressive.
But I think you're onto something, and I think it sort of comes back to what Mark and I were trying to get at with the free market. That part of those values is you need to find shared values amongst people who have different cultures or who themselves have different priorities. And that's why freedom has been one of the most popular memes in the history of human civilization, because while it doesn't mean the same to all people, there's something in it for everybody that gives them that shared sense of purpose, or that gives them that shared sense of what's possible. And I think we need that again. And I think transparency is part of it. I think that is something in the digital era that we kind of require to create that commonality. But I think there is an opportunity to find a kind of shared value set. And I think freedom is one example. And I think it's what we try to do on this podcast. That, you know, one thing we share is we all want to understand this cyberpunk dystopia that's rising. But we all sort of agree, yeah, we want to have freedom in a decentralized way that offers people opportunity and certain amount of agency and autonomy. So I think the platforms that exist today are designed to keep conversations like we're having from happening. right? They're designed to create flame wars. They're designed to create, you know, cancel culture and people going crazy to try to get after each other versus what we need, to your point, Charles, about the way in which those rules or protocols are enabled is a system that encourages that dialogue. And I think the paradox is rules. Because on the one hand, we're saying, yeah, there should be rules to make sure it's fair. But on the other hand, we can acknowledge that you reach a point of too many rules and it falls apart, that it becomes rigid and, you know, you get all sorts of other abuses. So we're talking about this sort of middle ground in which there's enough rules that people don't do bad stuff, but not too many rules that they feel that their freedom has been infringed upon. And I think to achieve that sweet spot requires a lot of dialogue around values and around what those shared values are. And none of our systems reward people for that right now. They reward people for the opposite. They reward people to go to the extreme and be the most vitriolic rather than finding compromise.
Well, that brings up a Pew Research data set that I've used several times in my blogs that show that there's no plurality in the middle anymore. And so you can only win a victory on one or the other extremes. And so my theory is that it will, in a pendulum-like motion, go to ever widening extremes on either side, which is a very bad thing. You said one of the oldest memes in history is freedom. One of the oldest memes in political history is change. If you just look through all these candidates of the past, and I did a little montage of it in my last band's video, it was just all these different politicians with the big banner that says change, and everything stays the same. You win the votes with change and you keep the system exactly the same. I would be negligent, I'm not going to turn this into a political dumpster fire, but I'm going to have to talk a little bit about socialism, otherwise my libertarian friends will hunt me down and kill me. I did an audio, and just let me finish. It'll be benign.
Why you're hanging out with people who would hunt down to kill you is a whole other question, but please continue.
I'll get canceled, not killed. I'll get canceled.
How could you be canceled? But please continue.
I did an audio book for Dr. Christian Nemitz from the some think tank in England. Socialism, the failed idea that never dies. And one of the first thing I asked him, I said, are people actually talking about socialism as we understand it, government ownership of the means of production, or there are different things that sound the same but mean very different things. Social democracy, Sweden, Norwegian style, is something very different from democratic socialism, which might be different from what people mean who are actually socialist or even communist. That said, I think there is, I mean, it's more than just a hint. There is a rising attraction to socialism as a revival. It mystifies me why it's not as reviled as fascism, but it's not. It's kind of trendy and it's kind of fashionable. So be it. But where it is in the Democratic Party, there's the Bernie brothers, the Bernie bros, where they actually advocating for socialism. Is AOC actually meaning actual socialism when she says she's a democratic socialist? I don't know. They've gone with more of a centrist Biden type person now, who actually has a bit of overlap with Trump on some of his policy issues.
Which was my point. I wasn't referring to the candidates who failed to win the nomination.
Right.
Nor was I referring to fringes of the party. But when they call Biden a socialist, you would agree with me that's absurd.
Yes. So, and that you actually...
That was my point.
You jogged my memory because I lost my train of thought. And so in another group yesterday or the day before, Tom Wood's elite group, we were talking about how frustrating it is that it's almost a trope that conservatives think everything is socialist that they don't like. Like everything from fire trucks to garbage collection to carpools, there's somebody saying that conservatives are calling it socialist. And I don't know, speaking as someone who's center right, we know that fire departments aren't socialist and carpooling isn't socialist and things we don't like aren't socialist by definition. I just think, I just wanted to get that in there. I'm not really disagreeing with anything you said
I didn't see the need for you to put that in there, but I acknowledge that you did. I was just pointing out that calling Biden a socialist is an offense to the English language, that there are more accurate words to use. If I were to push back, I would want to see your Pew research data that shows resurgent socialism. But I do agree that on the internet, there's a lot of young people who have no knowledge of history who are very much attracted to it. But there's also a lot of young people on the internet with no sense of history who are attracted to fascism. Right, I would say that both happen to be trending and to be resurgent. I was just pointing out that currently on Fox News and in the Republican Party, they're calling Joe Biden a socialist, and that's ludicrous. If my hero, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, were leading the Democratic Party or was the nominee for president, okay, call them socialist. I agree. But she's not. She has no power in the party whatsoever. And Bernie's not a member of the party. And most of his supporters are not members of the party. So that's why I just kind of feel we get into this real lazy kind of politics when people do that. But everything else you said was totally fair. And, you know, you have every reason to say it.
Okay, I have a fixation on balance, and I know you're gonna. Well, you might groan when I say this, okay? And I have to preface it.
Let me pre-groan, man.
Okay, for the 10 millionth time since 2016, I am not a Trump supporter. Okay.
Yeah, we know that.
But the same extreme kind of if calling Biden a socialist is like a crime in communications. Well, there's so much talk of the literally Hitler against Trump, and he's not literally okay. Hitler. He's not
no,
a fascist.
But hold on.
He's not.
Hold on. Actually, I think the case of him being a fascist is actually, I'm going to say conclusive, but it deserves its day in court.
Because of his use of executive orders, me?
Because of his use of violence, because of his understanding of the rule of law, because of the way in which he deliberately uses racism. Like, there's so many things that align him with the German National Socialism Party that, again, merits it having its day in court versus calling Biden a socialist. Any credible judge would say this court has no room for such spurious charges and would dismiss it immediately. So I'm not suggesting that Trump is a fascist. I'm just saying that the argument making that case has a lot of evidence backing it versus there is no evidence backing that Biden is a socialist. There is evidence suggesting that there are socialists active in the Democratic Party. I will grant you that. But there's no evidence that Biden or the faction currently in control of the Democratic Party has any relationship to socialism as, you know, you would have a relationship with socialism.
I'm going to kick it over to Charles.
Yeah, thank you. I'll be honest, I have zero interest in the general ideological, you know, the setup that you guys are talking about. I understand what the subject is of keen interest to many people. I immediately am thinking about Proudhon and the movement of in Europe that predated Marx that was keenly interested in socialism. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say a couple of sort of grounding comments about socialism is that socialism in the United States is often assumed to be free money from somewhere. And where that free money comes from is of no interest. Just give me the free money and I'm happy we call that socialism. Actually, that's not socialism. Socialism is the ownership of capital that's shared. And so we can talk about models of socialism, which would be communal ownership. And this was extremely common in the extreme capitalist stage. In other words, the village in, you know, medieval Europe that once feudalism ended, the village actually had a kind of ownership of common land, right? And this is the tragedy of the commons, right? And so if it's communal ownership of capital That's the fundamental definition of socialism. But it also requires agency, like you have a part to play, and it's a responsibility. You can't just go in and exploit the commons for your own self-interest. You have to share that and make a reasonable decision based on the needs of the community and the other participants and so on. And so the idea that ownership of capital could be communal is quite powerful. And Mark, to your point of the pendulum, I think people look at when they see like Jeff Bezos controls a fortune of $200 billion, which is larger than the GDP of many nations. And you go, well, what if I had 1% of Jeff Bezos' fortune? That would be $2 billion, which is larger than many city budgets and so on. So we're talking about extremes of ownership of capital and political power that can be purchased with that. That's why the pendulum is swinging back. And I just want to kind of differentiate between the sort of ignorant use of socialism and the idea that what people are actually craving is actually a positive thing, which is some sort of agency over the capital of their society and their economy, right? But there's a responsibility that's part of that. Once you are a worker-owned cooperative, that's socialism, right? That's a model that a lot of people look at. Well, guess what? It's hard to run those kinds of things. That's why they're not that common. It's hard. You have a shared responsibility.
I'd rather see that debate. I'd rather see someone, as Charles just did, explain socialism in terms that are accurate in terms of language, and then have someone else go, yeah, I was part of a co-op and I hated it. I don't want anything to... Gee, that's a fair debate. At least then dealing with the substance of it, rather than what I was objecting to, which is like... dystopia. That's the only word I can use to describe a society in which words are meaningless, in which you're taking a word and using it so completely disconnected from what it actually means that you're preventing debate, that you're inciting violence against anyone affiliated with that. I mean, it's ludicrous, but thank you, Charles. That was a very poetic way of describing or framing the debate at hand.
I would point out that even among libertarians and anarchists, they would look at the kind of thing Charles is talking about and say, that's perfectly fine. They have no ideological or moral objection to it, with the stipulation being that all the participants are doing so voluntarily and it's not being imposed on anyone.
And that's where Charles's point, which may have been subtle, so I will belabor it, is he didn't describe a state ownership of the economy, mm-hmm. right? Because it can be communal, right? An anarcho-communist believes in that social ownership of the means of production while also believing that there should be no state, that the state in and of itself is an immoral construct. So that's why I want to have these debates based on the words that mean what they do, rather than the propaganda and delusion that the media and the social media fosters.
So I think the common theme that we've hit on, I think people sense that there's this fundamental imbalance and asymmetry to the system that's leaving them on the short end of the stick. And so impulses towards solutions that sound democratic socialism or whatever sound appealing. And I think the common thread is that both terms, like even capitalism and democratic socialism, they have this tendency to be hijacked and co-opted by people who just want to run the apparatus of the state. So the most toxic forms of socialism that everyone will say it killed more people than fascism, well, that was a completely government top-down authoritarianism where the state owned the means of production. And they said, well, that's the state owns it, so you own it, comrade. And now move out of your house so we can put some other people in there. The last thing I was going to say to Charles's point about Jeff Bezos, which I also look at that and I sense that same asymmetry. But there's this misconception, I think, about super wealthy people that they, and Charles, I know, I don't think you subscribe to this, but just in general, people think he's worth $200 billion. He's got a swimming pool full of gold coins that he swims around in. And, every billionaire is a policy failure, but that's not really the case. It's more of he controls $200 billion worth of capital and where it goes. He doesn't, it's not withdrawn from the economy because he owns it. And in fact, because he's worth $200 billion, there's actually that multiplier effect in the economy. So Charles, to your point, if I could just have a fraction of a percent of Bezos's wealth, well, if you start an Amazon store and you do well at it, then you're directly participating in Bezos's wealth, but you're kind of tied to the company store. But I just wanted to clarify that. But I think there's sort of this...
Well, that's a brilliant point, because, you know, on the one hand, we think of these rich people as controlling the system. But at the same time, they're beholden to the system as well, right?
But they also influence it, to your point.
Their status and power is so intertwined that they want to exert their influence to pursue their self-interest. But they also don't want that system to collapse, because all their wealth collapses with it.
Right.
And that's the paradox, to your point, Mark, about all the politicians with the change banner behind their heads, right? There's lots of entrepreneurs. There's lots of billionaires who are like, yeah, I'm going to change the system. And then once they're part of the system, they're like, yeah, let's make sure the system keeps working the way it's working. I think Elon Musk is going through that exact personal transformation right now.
Well, I'll tell you something. Oh, go ahead, Charles.
No. Go ahead.
I mean, I probably was a burn it all down guy at some point. And then I've said before, I think 2008 was our last chance to really take the Austrian school economics response to an economic crisis and no bailouts and nothing like that. Now, I don't know, is it just that I'm older? Is it just that, but I look at it now and I say, yeah, you can't do that now. The ship has sailed on that. We have to keep this system on the rails. So we'll do whatever it takes to keep this system on the rails, because the alternative is nightmarish. And yet, I think what we talk about here is it won't stay on the rails, but... Sorry,
maybe,
go ahead.
Maybe what's changed is your awareness of how brittle it is.
Yeah, there's definitely an element of that to it.
Yeah, my final comment would be... Mark, I like your references to asymmetry and imbalances and hijack and co-opt. And I think what I see is, when you reach extremes like what we're talking about of asymmetry of power and capital, then the system is fragile, as Jesse's word, brittle. It's brittle, it's fragile, it's unstable. There's no way you're going to save it. That's just the way systems are. So as to Mark's point, that's the desperation we now sense, right? We can smell the desperation to keep it on the rails, but it's so asymmetric that it's unstable, and it's going to come apart for one reason or another because of the internal contradictions. So that's what we're talking about.
It's because it's off the rails. We want it to stay on the mountain. Right? It's rocking back and forth. We're going, oh no, it's off the rails. Which is Mark's point of, before, when it was on the rails, we're like, maybe we could stop it. And then you realize, no, it's not even on the rails. This thing's just moving. Like, okay, everyone lean on one side so it stays on the mountain. Lean on one side.
And jettison anything heavy. Just get it off the train.
What's that movie, Snowpiercer? Is that the title?
There's a whole series of that now. I haven't watched it, but...
But the film by the Korean director, right? Was that the name? That was the same scenario, right? The train's going through this snow world, and it goes off the rails. Yeah. Brilliant.
And on that note, post a comment below. Hit the like button. Subscribe. Share. Tell everyone how stupid we are.
Yeah.
Just make sure you send them to accessofeasy.com. Sorry, go ahead, Charles.
No, send a Benjamin, you know.
Actually, don't send a... Well, you can send a Benjamin, but go buy Charles's new book, A Hacker's Teleology. Do it today. I'll put a link in the show notes page.
And if you happen to have a firstborn named Benjamin, who's an expert in machine learning, we could build an algorithm advocate for all people, send them our way too, because in a feudal system, we could use such an apprentice.
Well said.
Thanks, and good night.